I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a woman who was told 14 years ago that she was HIV positive. Back then, Audrey Serrano had every reason to believe it was true. Her boyfriend at the time had confessed that he was HIV positive and that he wanted to take other people down with him. That's why Audrey went to get the test. And when she saw that the results marked her also as HIV positive, she was crushed. Her own family members shunned her, and she began a lengthy series of drug treatments. It was a full 9 years before Audrey found out she was clear. She'd never been HIV positive, and the evidence was there in the records.
All the years that doc treated me, and, you know, she never once thought to retest me, even with the recommendation of her own professionals.
Audrey Serrano sued that doctor. She won $2.5 million. I'll talk to her about what she went through right after the news. A whole lot has changed in the way that HIV and AIDS are regarded. I mean, if you were told back in 1994 that you were HIV positive, it was pretty well a death sentence. Look it up. 14, 15 years ago, AIDS was killing more young people in the U.S. than any other disease in the country. So when Audrey Serrano was told in 1994 that she was HIV positive, she figured her life was over. Her own sister wouldn't hug her, wouldn't even touch her.
I took a sip off her soda one time, and she literally wouldn't take her soda back. She told me to keep it, and I told her what for. I said, you can have it. I just wanted a sip. She said, no, that's okay. I don't want it. I said, okay, fine. Before that, we used to drink off each other all the time. When I used to go out to the bars with her, we used to share drinks. So I already knew.
Living 9 years with HIV and then finding out it's a mistake. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Audrey Serrano was out at a club one night when a couple of her friends pulled her aside. You know your boyfriend Dempsey, they told her? He tested positive for HIV. It's true, they insisted. Audrey didn't believe them. She thought it was just a bad joke.
When he came into the bar, I asked him flat out if he was HIV positive. And at first, he didn't want to tell me. He wanted me to come outside and chat with him. And I told him that I just wanted him to tell me the truth. And he told me, yeah, he did. When I asked him why didn't he give me the right to know, he told me that he just wanted to take as many people with him as he could, that he didn't want to die alone.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's what he told me. He just thought that he would have his way with me unprotected. And he did, one night.
And so you find out this night at the club that your boyfriend is HIV positive. He hasn't told you this. Are you certain at that point that you have HIV as well, or what are you thinking?
No, I didn't know. I really didn't want to think about it. I didn't know anything about HIV or anything else. To me, that was foreign. Other countries had that. I didn't know that that existed here, you know, back then.
I mean, let's face it. In 1994, a lot of people didn't know about HIV/AIDS at that time, and we know a whole lot more now. When you heard this from Dempsey, were you scared? Were you angry? What were you thinking?
I was mad, and I was hurt. And for me, I think I was more hurt that he didn't give me the choice, you know, that he didn't give me the right to choose whether I wanted to chance that or whether I wanted to be with him with that disease. He didn't give me a choice. He didn't even tell me anything about it or what it was or, you know, what that meant or anything. And me, I knew people died from it, but I didn't know nothing about it particularly. You know what I mean?
So what was it that led you to go and get tested?
My mother did. She kept asking me to go and get tested. So finally, her and I went, it's a free clinic, and I went there and got tested.
And did you get the results right away?
No. I had to wait for them, and they do anonymous testing, and they give you these numbers.
What, like a string of numbers? You're 123B47 or something like that?
Correct. And then a couple of weeks later, you have to go back and get the results.
Did you go back with your mother?
No, I did not. I went alone.
What were you thinking you'd find out?
I was scared. I didn't know if I had it or not, and I didn't want her to be there to hear the results if it was positive. I didn't want her to have to deal with that. When I got the results, the person that handed them to me told me that there were resources and that there was counseling out there.
The test said you were HIV positive, right?
Yeah, it did.
Well, Audrey, what was going through your mind when you found out?
When I first found out, it was like I was numb. Like I didn't know how to feel or what to think. It wasn't until I got in my car that I think it really hit me, because I just broke down and couldn't stop crying. And I just sat there in my car, and people were coming out in the parking lot and staring at me. So I just took off. And initially, I went home, but then I couldn't sit there. So I went to the cafe, and I ended up drinking. I hadn't drank in 3 years. And all of a sudden, I found myself just buying shot after shot and beer after beer. And next thing I know, I racked my car up. I ended up smashing my car into a boulder and flipping it on its roof, and I was arrested. It's the last thing I remember.
Did you go to prison for that?
Yes, I did.
How long did you have to stay in prison at that time, Audrey?
I was in Framingham for a month. I got really, really sick. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. I was already on the medication that my doctors told them that I was on.
Do you remember the effect of taking those meds when you started them?
Yes. I used to get deathly sick. I used to feel like I was going to die, like I was going to vomit my brains out. I had no energy. It used to literally knock me right out. I couldn't even get out of the bed half of the time.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. At this time, Audrey was simply assuming all her symptoms were part of being HIV positive. It would be years before she finally discovered that the whole thing was a mistake, and years after that before she successfully sued her doctor. But back in the 90s, Audrey thought she was infected, and so did everyone else. After she left prison and went back home, her health just got worse and worse.
I had no energy, literally, whatsoever. DSS took my daughter away because they said that I could no longer take care of her.
How old was she at the time?
9 years old. So, I mean, there's just so much to this, you know, the effects and the damages and everything else. And that's not even pertaining to the colitis, the irritable bowel syndrome, the emphysema, hair loss, constant bruising, asthma, which is all things that I never had before I started on the meds. Also, pneumonia. And they told me that it was PCP pneumonia. Now, that's only a pneumonia that you get from HIV. We all now know I never had PCP because I don't have HIV. So, therefore, the pneumonia I had was due to the drugs.
All these things that you were going through, were you thinking that they were related to the fact that you had HIV?
Yes. I thought it was because I was getting sicker and sicker. Because at one time, my doctor had diagnosed me with full-blown AIDS.
I mean, you must have thought you were dying.
Yes, I did. And, like, right now, one of the things that's the hardest for me, you know, is, like, okay, when I first got out of jail, okay, for the DWI, I broke sobriety one more time. And the thing that got me sober was sitting in the street in a puddle of mud. I was in a blackout, and I was sitting there in the pouring rain in a puddle of mud. And next thing I knew, I woke up on my kitchen floor full of mud, took a shower. And then, you know, I fought so hard to get sober and to realize that I didn't want to die. You know, that's how hard I fought for life. I fought to live.
Did you ever say to the doctor, how bad is my HIV, or you know, can I be retested? Did this ever occur?
Yes. I told her how sick the meds used to make me all the time, and I used to complain about that a lot. Back in 97, I believe, was the first time I ever asked her to retest me, and she wouldn't. She said no. She told me that I was just in denial and that I was setting myself up, that I've already been tested enough. She actually put in my record, she said, Audrey still does not believe that she's HIV. She says, we have tested her 2 more times last year, which means right there that I asked her to retest me, because otherwise why would she put in there that Audrey still does not believe that she's HIV?
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story and the struggle that Audrey Serrano went through when she found she'd been misdiagnosed as HIV positive. Audrey only got those medical records when she took her doctor to court. And at the time when she was questioning the diagnosis, she was on her own. She'd read a magazine article about someone else who'd been misdiagnosed, and her own doubts persisted. So finally, 9 years after she'd been told she was HIV positive, she gathered up the courage to go to a different clinic and get tested again.
I wanted to know. I wanted the truth, whether I had it or not. That's when I tried to find some place to get retested.
And what were the results of that test?
That was negative.
And so what are you thinking at this point? Like, who's telling you the truth?
At that point, I was confused. Yeah, so I went and had another test done. That test there, I had to pay $300 for. And then I still wasn't convinced. So I had called Quest again, and I had to pay $200 there. Every test came up negative. Then after that, I went to the VNA and got tested there because I still wasn't convinced. After that, I went to AIDS Project Clinic. I still wasn't convinced. I didn't know whether to trust them or not. So that's when I called Dr. Williams and ended up having 2 more tests done.
And what did he tell you? What did this second doctor tell you?
Well, he wasn't convinced on the other test either. He didn't know whether to believe him or not, especially the ones that only had the codes on them.
At this point, Audrey, I'm getting a little bit confused. You've been on antiretroviral drugs for 9 years at this point, and you're going to get these AIDS tests from different clinics, and they're all coming up negative. I mean, I wouldn't know what to believe. I wouldn't know if, you know, the HIV had come and then gone because now I'm negative because I've been taking the drugs, or if I never had it in the first place. What are you thinking?
I didn't know what to believe either. It's like even now, okay, I've been diagnosed as negative now for 4 years, I think, and I still don't believe it half of the time. It's like 1 minute my mind tells me that I'm HIV negative, and then the next minute, I find myself questioning and living as though I do, especially with all the things wrong with my body and everything else and the depression and everything that goes along with it. It's like, okay, I got to be careful for this. I got to be careful for that bacterial or this infection or what have you. You know, it's hard to believe that I don't have it even now, and it's 4 years later.
Audrey Serrano tried to talk to her doctor, but the doctor's defense was, essentially, that Audrey had lived a high-risk life and that the HIV diagnosis was reasonable. I'll talk with Audrey about her own troubled youth in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. By anyone's estimate, Audrey Serrano is a wealthy woman today. Or she will be when she gets the $2.5 million that a jury awarded her when they heard her tell her story. You see, Audrey was misdiagnosed as being HIV positive back in 1994. She didn't find out about the mistake until 2003, and then the court awarded her the $2.5 million just a couple of months ago. You know what? Even with that kind of award, you wouldn't want to trade places with Audrey. She's lived a really rough life in and out of foster homes, places where she was abused and raped. The home life, she told me about, was no better. Her mother was routinely beaten by her father and by other men.
My mom wasn't supposed to play with us or nothing, but my mom used to make, you know, the cereal boxes? She used to take the cereal boxes and she used to rip them open and she used to make game boards on them. And she used to sit and play with us when my dad wasn't home. But when he came home, we had to hurry up and get back in the room because he used to lock us in our rooms. And we always saw the aftermath, especially like when my mom's face was all busted up and her mouth was all split open and her eyes were all black and blue and stuff. And one time, my mom didn't know I saw, though, when I was looking out the window. she wasn't supposed to hang clothes during the day. Well, this day she was. And my dad went out, dragged her by the head of the hair. He was in his boxers. And I didn't know. For a long time, I thought it was a bad dream I had. But then finally, I asked my mom about it. And she told me that it was true. It was like a dream kept coming back to me. By that time, I was almost five. It was right before we left.
Did you or your brothers or sister ever try to call the police or get help for your mother?
I used to do that with one guy who used to beat my mom. And I used to go down, and you know them red phones? You pick them up, and the police come in a real hurry. They're on the streets.
Yeah, the pull boxes.
Yeah, well, I used to sneak out and run down and pull that phone. And then the cops would come, and I would bring them to my house. My mom and me, we used to hide, though, a lot of times. Like, we used to hide in the cellar, or we would run to my auntie's house and stuff like that.
You and your mother were very close, right?
Always, until DSS took me away. Because the school used to strip me, and they saw welt marks all over me. And they said my mom did it, but I told them that she didn't. I told them it was my sisters and their friends, because they used to make me kneel down on split peas and rice and hold books up in the air and put their feet on my shoulders and stuff. And they used to whip me with dog chains and belts. And they used to feed me alcohol when I was 8 years old and give me cigarettes. Stuff like that.
Audrey was in and out of foster homes after that, and through her own series of abusive relationships. When she was a teenager, she met Louis, a man she thought would help her. But Louis introduced her to what would ultimately be a much more dangerous situation. He got her into exotic dancing.
I started at this club in Leominster. The boss knew how old I was, but the others didn't know how old I was.
What were you, 16?
No, I was 17.
Still too young to be exotic dancing, right?
Yeah, back then.
So why were you doing it? Were you being told to do it or being forced to do it, or was that your choice?
No. Louis told me to, so I did. I didn't know how to dance. I didn't know anything. I just kept wanting to learn and learn and learn. And one thing led to another. I started going like from club to club, featuring and stuff like that. It just took off from there. You know, I was drinking a lot. I tried a couple of drugs here and there and didn't like how those made me feel. So I just continued with the drinking and that kind of stuff from there on.
Were you thinking at the time, Audrey, that you might be able to make a good living, a career as a dancer?
No, I didn't think about it. I was just surviving. I wasn't here, even though I was here. I kept going into detoxes and stuff, trying to get my life together and trying to get clean.
How long did that go on, that life?
I think I might have been around 21, but it wasn't constant. It was like off and on.
Do you have any one clear memory of that time when you were dancing and drinking that you think about?
The time when a friend of mine got murdered. She had a 3-year-old son at the time. And the cops came to my house, I think around 6 o'clock in the morning, asking me about her. After that, I think that's what really woke me up and, you know, made me realize that I didn't want the same thing to happen to me.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Audrey Serrano finally managed to get herself together, to get sober, in her late 20s. And it was about that time when she was told that she was HIV positive. That sent her spiraling down again. The worst of that time was that people in her own family, one sister, wanted nothing to do with her then.
One in particular was afraid to even touch me. She wouldn't hug me. She wouldn't drink after me. I took a sip off her soda one time, and she literally wouldn't take her soda back. She told me to keep it, and I told her what for. I said, you can have it. I just wanted a sip. She said, no, that's okay. I don't want it. I said, okay, fine.
Would she say why?
No, she did not.
She didn't have to, right?
No, because before that, we used to drink off each other all the time. When I used to go out to the bars with her, we used to share drinks. So I already knew.
What about other situations where you felt that you were being discriminated against or badly treated because of your HIV status?
Well, there's plenty of times. There was an eye doctor. that wouldn't even give me eyeglasses. He wouldn't even test me properly. You know the chin rester thingy?
Yeah.
When you look into the machine, and I looked into the machine, and he actually put paper towels down. And then after I was done, he actually wiped down the machine right in front of me.
Audrey Serrano never was HIV positive. The diagnosis was a mistake that had been made years earlier. Audrey recently won a multi-million-dollar settlement when she took that doctor to court. I asked Audrey if she ever confronted that person, if she'd ever tried to talk with the doctor who treated her.
No, I never went back to her. Dr. Williams called her, though.
The second doctor that you went to?
Yes, he called her.
What was she saying?
She didn't say anything. She didn't even call me. She never once called me to see how I was. She never once called me to see if I was all right, if there was anything she could do for me, or even to apologize. She never once contacted me, never even attempted to. And I feel like all the years that doc treated me, and there was papers in my records that stated there is no HIV antibodies found in this patient's system, and recommended that I be retested. And it's right in my records. And, you know, she never once thought to retest me, even with the recommendation of her own professionals. So why did my life mean so little to her when it meant so much to me? You know, she acted like it was no big deal.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, honest to God. In court, she was so nonchalant about it all. When my attorney asked her, did she ever once call me? She said no. And he asked her, well, did you ever think to call her to see if she was all right or how she was doing? And she said no. What for? That's just what she said right there on the stand. She said, what for?
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Although Audrey Serrano found the confidence to take her doctor to court, it doesn't mean she was fully past that sense that she was still living with HIV. That perpetual feeling she describes, that she's always sick.
I'm still working on it. I think that it's going to take a long time. You know, I still haven't fully accepted it yet, because I think with all the things wrong with my body still, and my mind still plays tricks, it's like, okay, one minute I know I don't have it, but the next minute I don't. It's hard to explain the way that my mind goes. I know I don't have it, but then again, at times I live as though I do.
How long did the whole court process take, though? I mean, that must have been difficult for you.
4 years. Yeah, very stressful, very hard. It's a constant struggle. And with it still hanging over the ballots, I think until resolution and restitution is finally granted once and for all, I think that it's going to be hanging over me.
During all the years that this went through the courts, the 4 years that you were waiting, you didn't have to take the HIV drugs anymore. Did your health improve? Are you feeling better than you were back then?
As far as the deathly overwhelming feeling, yes, that part has subsided. It's not so that I'm sick to my stomach every single day. But as far as the colitis, the irritable bowel syndrome, the wasting and that sort of stuff, no. The depression, no.
But you were in the courtroom in mid-December when the jury read out the verdict awarding you $2.5 million in pain and suffering for what you'd been through. Tell me what that day was like for you.
I don't know how to put it into words. It was like the first thing I did was asked, was it real? You know, does that mean it was in my favor, you know, that the judge and the jury believed me? And it felt really good to know that they knew for a fact that I was telling the truth. And I hugged my mom, and then my attorney hugged me, and I gave him a hug, you know, and thanked him so much for the great job that he did. You know, and I can't take the credit for that because I didn't win the case. My attorney did. You know, all I did is told the truth.
You should take a fair amount of credit for sticking to your story and seeing through the years of suffering that you did, though. That's certainly to your credit.
Thank you.
Tell me what it's like for you to go to a doctor's office. today. You seem to have had just such a rough time with getting straight answers from the medical profession. What's that like for you?
None of them like treating me anymore. Nobody likes me anymore. And I've tried to find another doctor, but no doctor will take me. Every time they hear my name or see my number come up on their caller ID, they tell me they ain't taking new patients.
Because you sued a doctor who treated you badly?
Yep. That's right. Absolutely. And even my doctor now, they're afraid to diagnose me with anything. It's like pulling teeth just to get them to say what's wrong with me. They're all afraid to diagnose me with anything, even so much as a cold.
I know some really good ones. I have a hard time believing there isn't a doctor anywhere who'd just take you as a patient.
Well, I'm talking about the ones that I've called so far.
Yeah.
So my attorneys are going to help me find a good doctor that will treat me and treat me right.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The other benefit to Audrey Serrano is that the years of fighting for herself have also given her the strength to speak up for herself. She recently went for the test results of a colonoscopy, and then she called the doctor's office when the information she got didn't add up.
They tried telling me that the tests were fine, but only she didn't know that the Worcester Fallon had already sent me my results showing me that I had the colitis, and I had told her, I said, how's that? I happen to know for a fact that I have the colitis and the irritable bowel syndromes. And she's like, how do you know that? And I'm like, because I got my results from the Worcester office. They sent them to me. And she's like, oh, how'd you manage that? How'd you get those? You weren't supposed to get those. I said, excuse me, those are my records. I'm entitled to them. And I think it was like 3 days later, she quit. A week after that, I get a letter in the mail telling me that she was no longer my doctor. And I'm like, okay.
Have you got your daughter back?
Yes. I fired my court appointee and took over the case myself. Means I went to a law library and started studying up the laws and buying my own law books, doing my own motions and everything else in court in order to get my daughter back.
You're studying law now, aren't you?
Yes. I graduate from my associate's degree in paralegal this May, May 17th.
What about a personal life? Are you going to have a personal life again?
Oh, I don't date no one. I haven't dated no one since Dempsey.
Dempsey was the guy who was HIV positive way back in the early 90s, right?
Yes. I haven't had sex with anyone since him. Don't intend to. I tried dating a couple of times, like, you know, just casual, going out to movies and stuff. But when people get to know me, they don't want that. They want more than that, so I lose them as friends. They go away. Since I've been HIV negative, I've thought about dating, but then I get scared. Actually, I get petrified. Because, you know, what if somebody has something and they don't tell me? You know, you never know what you're getting these days. You know? And who knows? They might give me something next time that, you know, I really do get diagnosed with, and it's for keeps.
You know, Audrey, there's going to be a lot of people listening to you tell your story about being misdiagnosed with HIV and taking all those years of drugs and then 4 years in the cord and trying to get things back together right now. What do you think is the lesson in your story that other people should take?
That they should get retested and retested again for any diagnoses, especially if they have a question about it. And even if their doctor tells them no, that they already been tested enough, go someplace else. Just go someplace else. Don't listen to it and don't trust it, especially if it's a deadly diagnosis, not just HIV.
And what about the lesson in determination? I'm thinking of that description that you gave me of yourself, all covered in mud in the gutter, and look at you now. I mean, it's quite remarkable just how much strength you've shown.
Thank you. Never give up. You just keep on going. You know, I don't know how or when I began to believe in myself, but somewhere along the trail, I started believing in me and that I deserve something better, you know, and started respecting myself looking in the mirror and saying, okay, I like me. Even though I really didn't feel it at the time, I just kept telling myself that every morning I got up, I'd look in the mirror and say, okay, Audrey, I like me just a little bit for now, and that's okay. And pretty soon you start feeling it and believing it and knowing it. It doesn't matter what you're living with. Just know that you're important and that you count and you matter. Go with your first instinct and believe in yourself and never give up.
Audrey Serrano lives in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, where she set up a nonprofit organization for families against violence. And we have a link to that on our website, and you can find that at thestory.org. In just a moment, we'll listen in on what was meant to be just a little white lie. But this was a lie that crossed oceans and languages and cultures and three generations before it was confronted. Sound familiar? Yes, we all have our family secrets. This one's coming up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I think we're all raised with the idea that there are different kinds of lies. Big lies, small lies, good lies, bad lies, little white lies. Steve DeJoseph has a story about a lie that persisted through three generations of his family. It started with Steve's grandfather. He moved here all on his own from Italy. And Steve says his grandpa got the idea to move from a magazine.
He was actually working with his grandfather in the vineyards up in the mountains. And there was a National Geographic. There was articles in there about the United States. And he told his grandfather that, hey, I'm going to go there someday. And unfortunately, we never found out where that magazine, how they came to have their hands on a magazine like that up in the mountains.
And this is like 100 years ago, right?
This is
almost sort of 1908 or something.
So that was kind of neat.
When he came to the U.S., he came by himself, right? And he was just a teenager?
That's correct. He came by himself. There was a family that he was going to meet up with. And he came the normal way through Ellis Island and, had instructions on how to get to where he needed to go, and he accomplished that.
Soon after he got here, he was sending money back home.
Once he went to work, yes.
Did he come here so he could make money and send it back home?
Yes, that was his motivation. His family was poor, and he left behind a couple of brothers, sister, and his mom and dad, and he never saw them again.
And was he successful? Did he send a lot of money back home?
I think so. I can recall him telling the story that he worked in one of the steel mills during World War I, shortly after he came to the U.S. in the Buffalo area. I remember him telling me he was working about 80 hours a week, nonstop for a year, and he made $18,000,
which was a huge amount of money back then.
It was, and I'm sure he sent a fair portion, and he continued to send money back long after he retired, right through to his death. And he never really discussed it much other than when the topic came up about this family back in Rome. At some point he would say that, well, they're no good. They never say thanks for the money. And this went on my whole life. I heard this. Of course, my father and his brother and sister, they all grew up hearing this message that this family was no good and they never said thanks, because as the years went on, we encouraged my grandfather to go back home for a visit. But he always found an excuse why not to go. But he continued to send the money and he continued to complain about it.
He lived here, what, 60, 65 years, and he never once went back home.
That's correct.
To Italy.
That's correct.
And when he said, Steve, to you, you know, they're all a bunch of bums, or, you know, they never say thanks for the money. Did you ever say to him, what are you talking about? What do you mean? I mean, did anybody ever ask him to explain why he kept saying this?
No. It was just something that was you grew up with, and, it, you know, Grandpa said this was the way it is, and that's the way it is.
While your grandfather was still alive, did you ever doubt the truth of what he was saying? That all those people in Italy are no good and they never say thank you for the money?
Yes, I did doubt it. I didn't really... the only person I really discussed that with was my father. I didn't really discuss it with my grandfather. Knowing my grandfather, there was no way I was going to make a point with him. Just a kind of a sidebar, back in 1969, I can recall, in July of 1969, the family was gathered around the television in my grandfather's house watching and listening to Walter Cronkite talk about the landing on the moon. And
right.
You know, it was very exciting. And my grandfather, once it was over with, he said, there's no way. It's impossible. And to his dying days, he refused to believe
that man had landed on the moon.
Yeah, that man had landed on the moon. And if he couldn't touch it, taste it, see it, he had great difficulty accepting it. So I knew arguing with him about the landing on the moon and trying to convince him otherwise was hopeless. So trying to question him about his comments about the family back home for him was futile. I mean, it didn't even cross your mind because you weren't going to get anywhere with it.
Tell me, though, a little bit more about your father's thinking. Did he take this line from his father and simply accept that the people in the old country were no good?
Yes, he accepted it and he defended it. I started working on my dad to go over to Italy for the visit, myself, my father, and my mother.
Yeah. What did they think of it? Were they keen to go?
No. My father said, you know, they're no good. There's no point in going there. They never say thanks for the money. I said, Dad, you know.
How do you know?
You know that can't be true. I mean, this doesn't make any sense after all these years. And I said, he's still sending money after all these years. If he really felt they were no good, why did he send the money? And my father didn't have an answer for that one. So it was a few months later, he agreed to go, and I proceeded with making arrangements. And then, unfortunately, a short time after that, my mother passed away. So we kind of put the kibosh on the trip, and then about a year later after that, I started working on my father again.
Now it was going to be just the two of you going.
Just the two of us, and he finally agreed to go. And then it was a few months after that that he passed away. Probably another year or so went by, and woke up one morning, and my wife said, you need to go. I said, go where? She says, you need to go to Rome and see the family. I says, you know, you're right, I do. Yeah, I wanted to make it happen immediately.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. So Steve DeJoseph makes his own plan to go to Italy. Steve's been in touch with a cousin who lives there, a woman called Sandra, who speaks both English and Italian. She'll be his translator. And once he gets there, he's treated wonderfully. He hops in a car for the ride out to the family area, to Castelluccio, to meet the people who knew his grandpa as a kid. And Steve's looking around, and he's thinking how beautiful it all is and how nice the people are, and he's turning over the words of his grandfather, these people are no good, they never say thank you for the money, and he concludes that things aren't adding up.
Riding up there in the car, I can remember it was a warm day, but not warm enough to sweat. But I think I was sweating quite a bit from just being nervous about approaching this village and the family history of it. And me not knowing anything about it, the excitement of it. I was probably even shaking at the time until we got inside the home and met some of the townspeople, the village people.
Did you feel welcomed?
Oh, yeah.
From the very moment?
I felt like I belonged there. I mean, it's just old, old world. One Saturday evening, there was church service. The church was 1,200 years old, very small church. And I remember sitting in the pews with my cousin, and I noticed that they were very worn, like an old stair step in an old home, just from people going up and down the stairs. And I thought, is it possible? So I asked my cousin, how old are these pews? She goes, well, they were replaced 250 years ago, like it was done yesterday.
They're brand new. Why are you complaining?
Yeah. So that was very enlightening.
When you're going to Castelluccio for that family gathering, are you thinking to yourself, I wonder if I'm going to meet the rotten side of the family, the people who really were no good? I mean, was there ever a point on your trip back home to your family home when you thought to yourself, maybe I am going to run into a bunch of, you know, thugs and thieves, and maybe my grandfather was right after all?
I didn't think that for a minute before I left, and it never occurred to me while I was there that, you know, the next cousin I'm going to meet just got out of jail yesterday or something like that. I didn't have that sense at all. It was just the opposite, because I knew what the truth was. I just hadn't quite...
Well, you suspected what the truth was.
I suspected. That's correct. I suspected what it was, but I hadn't quite uncovered it just yet.
And everyone you met, or every day that you spent, another day that you spent in Italy, was convincing you that you basically had this terrific family.
They were very thankful for what my grandfather had done.
Had he sent them enough money to have made a difference? I mean, when you look at the lives that they were living, or when you talk to them about how they'd managed through those two wars and in the years after that, were they thankful to your grandfather for the money that he'd sent?
Yes, they said so. And I think through their entrepreneurship and their hard work and the money that came in, they turned their whole lives around. One of the cousins owned every gas pump in the city of Rome, which was, you know, I was very humbled.
That's a lot of-
I was the poor person there, believe me. My last night there, they had a pizza party, if you will, a wine and pizza party for me, and the pizzas they cooked in outdoor wood-fired stone ovens that had been used for 1,200 years there.
Yeah.
We're sitting around the table, and Sandra says, Steve, they want to know why your grandfather never came back here. And at that point, it hit me like a ton of bricks that my whole trip there had one purpose in mind, and that was to bring them this message that I wasn't aware that I was going to make until she asked me the question.
This is a huge dilemma for you. What are you going to do? Are you going to tell all these, you know, the old family relatives that they're no good and they never said thank you for the money?
Right. And so what I told Sandra was, I said, I don't know how well you can translate what I'm about to say, but my grandfather grew up with his family telling a little white lie about you guys. And it was all about protecting his feelings, his sensitivities to the family he left behind as a teenager, never seeing his mother and father and his siblings again. But I said, my short time here, I felt like I didn't want to go back home. I mean, they were truly family. The passion and compassion was just overwhelming, and they treated me no different than anybody else. They didn't treat me any special. It's just the way they managed everything. And I said that my grandfather raised us with this little white lie to protect his feelings that you folks were no good and never said thanks for all the money he sent you.
You told them that.
I told them that. And I said, you got to realize that if he'd have come here for a visit, there's no way he could have gone back to the United States, back home to the family that he created there. And he wasn't going to hurt himself emotionally again or feel like he was going to hurt either side of the family. So his best bet was to stay put. And I said, you got to realize how difficult you're making it for me to go back home to my wife and four daughters and a job. So if you can translate that, you know, have at it. Which she did, and there was much crying, and all these people from the village got up and hugged and kissed me, and she said, they're thanking you for that. They've been waiting all these years, all these decades, to hear this particular answer, and it's the right one.
What was going on in your mind or in your heart? What were you feeling?
I was very overwhelmed by it, and I felt my grandfather and my mother and father were with me there, so they experienced it too. So it was a very positive and warm type feeling, and kind of bridging the gap completely, and also this message that I could take back to my family, because they knew I had gone there, but they had no idea what was really going on with this little story about my grandfather and his white lie that he told all those years.
So the message that you took at that village family gathering was that you'd been told all your life, and your grandfather had said all your life and all his life, if the people in that village were no good and they never said thank you for the money. And even when the people there heard that translated, they understood it to be his way of saying, I got to find a reason not to go back, because if I go back, I'll stay.
Yes. They knew I was sitting there to tell them that. That was the only reason I was there.
Your grandfather's been dead now almost 25 years. If you had a chance to say something to him, having been back to Italy, having had the opportunity to meet all the family that he left behind, what would you say to him?
That's a good question. If there was a way I could have got him to share his true feelings, I think that would have been important to put your arm around him and say, hey, look, I understand.
Steve DeJoseph joined me here in the studio in Chapel Hill. Perhaps Steve's look back over his own history has you thinking of a story that somehow marked your family, something you were told, a family truth that was always accepted, never challenged. These are the ways that we figure out how our ancestors, how our relatives tick. And what they tell us, the truths and the little lies, well, these are the stuff of good stories. Today, if you have one, you can get in touch with me. Go to our website at thestory.org. Lots of little contact buttons there, ways of letting me know what's going on in your family, sharing a story. Speaking of family stories, coming up tomorrow on The Story, the descendants of a Rhode Island blue blood family confront the fact that their wealth and the social comfort they've taken for granted end up being a direct result of the fact that their ancestors were the biggest slave trading family in Bristol, Rhode Island. Katrina Brown says she always knew that her ancestors had been involved in the slave trade, but it wasn't the kind of thing she ever really wanted to learn that much more about. And then her own grandmother wrote an essay linking her family, the DeWolf family, directly to the slave trade. And Katrina started doing her own research.
It's one thing to learn this from your grandmother in a desktop published little booklet. It's another thing to go into a bookstore, get a book off the shelf called The Slave Trade, and go to the index and find DeWolf in the index. And that was one of those shocking moments where I was like, you know, maybe I'd been hoping it was all just made up after all. but there they were in ink in a bookstore, in a book. And then the even bigger shock, and this was a discovery that I made that I haven't had anyone in the family say that they already knew this, because basically because we weren't really thinking about it, talking about it, processing it, no one had gone and looked up the scholarly research. So I did get my hands on a book by Jay Cawtrey called The Notorious Triangle. So I went, looked up DeWolf in the index, went to those pages, and there it was. It said, without a doubt, the DeWolfs had the largest share in the American slave trade of any family before or after the Revolution.
Several members of the DeWolf family joined with Katrina in her own journey to learn more about and to face the family's past as slave traders. As they traveled, they took some video, made a film about their journey. One of them wrote a book about what they discovered. And Katrina Brown, the person who put the whole thing together, we'll be here to talk about it. That's The Story, coming up tomorrow at this time. As I mentioned, if you have a family story of your own that you'd like to share, I'd like to hear from you. You can write me a letter. Our mailing address is The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It's 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. And if you're feeling lazy, you just want to pick up the phone and mumbled a few sentences down the line to me. We will record that on our storyline at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. Of course, the fastest way to get to me is through our website at thestory.org. You can see all kind of archived material there, but it's also the fastest way to get to me with something brand new. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.